Well, I was born in Cornwall and spent the first 18 years of my life living in St. Ives. So I'm from the south, but like a lot of Cornish young people, there was no work and I wanted to get an education. And so I left and moved to London. Education was absolutely fundamental to my mum's outlook on life. She left school at 14. She came from the north. And one of the, I think, the founding, I think all families have stories in their background that give an indication as to why somebody holds the feelings that they have. And my mum, when I was in my 30s, told me this story about her education, because she left school at 14 and then went to work as a secretary and then has done various jobs. And at the time that I came around to writing this poem, I was writing something about rubbish dumps, because I got this commission to write about landfill sites. And it was all getting quite technical, and I started to think about, well, what are the stories of people who've been thrown on the scrap heap, people who've got shameful secrets that they like to cover over, and they don't go away. And I think it took my mum 33 years to tell me this story. It's a new poem. An education. A northern classroom after the war. And my mother has her hand in the air. She wants to try for grammar school. Oh, the teacher smiles. Put it down. Next day, at the front, there's a box, gift wrapped, and my mother's called up. She's thrilled. She likes nice things, but can't think what she's done. As she reaches to pick it up, the teacher takes hold of her wrist and squeezes. No, you must open it in front of the class. The clock cuts one moment from the next. Should she save the wallpaper? The outer layer reveals a lidded box. Heat glazes her face as the class gazes like sunlight through a magnifier at her fingernails. Inside, she finds another box, string tied, the paper fingernail creased. She picks at the knot as she will always pick at the knot, her nails bitten to the quick. And yes, there's only another, brown paper this time, the kind that wrapped everything back then, the paper of dispatch and back office, of shop counter and bags, of seconds, minutes, hours, clocks, and klaxons. Open it. It's yours, the teacher urges. And inside the box is nothing. And inside nothing, another box in which my mother prays. That is why I'm stood before you today, because she cared desperately about our education. And we were the first, all four of us, all four of my family went to university. So I didn't have that experience. I was brought up in St. Ives, one of the most beautiful places in the country. And my cousins are fishermen, my uncles are fishermen. And I've spent most of my life within 15 minutes' walk of the beach. I swam in it, I surfed, and I fished, but I was useless as a fisherman. I would sit on Smeaton's Pier at the very end, hour after hour, looking down into the beautiful, clear Atlantic water, and I'd catch absolutely nothing. But every now and again, shoals of fish would come into the harbor. Now, these shoals were grey mullet, which are probably the wiliest and most difficult fish you can hope to try to catch. They have very small mouths, and they have very soft lips. So they have a tendency to escape, and you have to use coarse fishing tackle in order to try and catch them. You have to use bread and worms. And anyway, I never caught them, so I wouldn't know what the right thing to do was. Anyway, this is just about that. Grey mullet. Their mouths were small, lips too soft to tether a run, or bear their weight when hoisted up by hook alone. I never owned a landing net, but read the book, and rolled the crumb of bread into a seed of dough that hid the hook. Sometimes the bait would dance, like a table at a séance, until it fell away eclipsed. More often, they just hovered around by the steps, around green chains, scaling the distance between boat and shadow, as if they listened out for someone to arrive, enthralled by a sound on the edge of their hearing. So that's grey mullet. I live in Scarborough, and when I first moved to Scarborough 12 years ago, it felt like coming home. St. Ives, where I was brought up, is now owned by completely different people. It's changed beyond recognition from the Bible-filled, chapel-going place that I knew as a child and as a Methodist, because my parents were strict Methodists. And in fact, that's one of the things that I think when my mother moved down to Cornwall, that's where she found her home, in the Methodist church, because, you know, it was 13 hours drive away from where she was brought up. So Methodism, absolutely key in bringing the North and South together in a sort of common community of faith and activism too. Because curiously, yes, I'm afraid we can't do that. So, when I moved to Scarborough, the natural thing to do was to get in the sea. So, I did, and I started swimming regularly. And I'm now going to read a couple of poems about swimming in the North Sea, which is quite different to the soft, gentle, clear waters of the Atlantic, but absolutely thrilling to me as a result. Takes a little bit of getting used to the cold water. It's a bit like chili. You know, first of all, you think, why do people put this stuff in their mouths? And then suddenly you want more and more and more. So I haven't been in for a week or two. It's starting to get cold, but I will be swimming through the winter. One of the great pleasures of swimming in the sea, particularly in the North Sea, is when it rains. I think I swim in order to not be an Iron Man, I swim in order to see the land from a different perspective and to have the living daylights knocked out of my head when I dive into the water and come up and it's, wow, the world is suddenly there afresh all over again. And there's something timeless about the experience of swimming because you leave no trace in the sea. Sometimes it's as if I'm the five-year-old boy reaching and performing the breaststroke that I used to perform in the Atlantic, only it's very different. So anyway, this poem is called Rain Swim. The acoustics of the sea when it rains is one of the great pleasures of swimming in all kinds of weather. Rain Swim. How everywhere it comes at once dissolves its entrance. The fog unburdens in light so even we cannot see the drops that makes the sea spring up forests of small elastic stalagmites. How the world turns through us, our bodies floating off record, needle poised. Now there's nothing to utter other than tinny fizz, shifting everywhere in, filling the horizon with here. We are fortunate in Scarborough, and this is a sort of small distinction, but it's important. We never ever dreamt of swimming out of beach huts. You know, we never had beach huts. You just left your stuff on the beach and you went in. Maybe you went into the shelters, but the swimming club that we set up as part of the Cultural Olympiad has two beach chalets, and they're so central to the life of the swimming club. It's where we get changed. It's where we have our basins of hot water that we put our feet in order to come back to life after a swim. It's where we used to hold creative writing workshops and art projects would take place. And they were kind of our hub for the exploration of the way in which swimming in the sea affects your imagination, affects the way you feel about yourself. Anyway, so this is a poem about beach chalets, and it makes a simple comparison between the stanza, which is the little room of the poem, and the beach hut, which is the little room where the body lives and hugs itself before it risks all in the North Sea. Anyway, beach chalets. Beach chalets are small wooden stanzas in which words undress and step from the damp boards and 60-watt bulbs into colossal light, blinking, rubbing arms, lifting a little on their toes, as if trying to see over the cold, ready as they will never be, for the body to speak itself again for the first time in the mouth of the North Sea. The body like a bell note struck by an iron key, wordless in a furl of murk, weed, someone's foot, and up, shouting, turnstones overhead, the Hispaniola rocking by, treading water back into now, rooted in all the strange words, children, parents, in hands that have held and let go, swimmers in song. That's beach chalets. One of the things that I'm always moved by is when I'm stood at the water's edge and I can hear the swimmers that I swim with, if I've got out earlier, talking amongst themselves out at sea, and it's broken by the sound of the North Sea waves, you know, crashing and that white noise, and then there'll be a lull and I'll hear them again. And it's extraordinary. You can work out who it is who's out at sea. And it never ceases to make me marvel over the fact that we can make these sounds and communicate our sense of who we are, our position in the world, across the gap, across the cold North Sea in this instance. So this is a poem that comes in and out of focus, in and out of clarity. And it's about that. Landing. Voices at sea. Warm chirrup. Checkered shell, bright things silvering in, out, a missed word heard as the sound of you tucked in crush of air, accumulated falling waves jostling, cauliflower lit, glass, pearl, prinking, muscle fragments among stones, this scouring veil through which breath spans and lands toeholds in us, sand falling away and lifted to any foot, your foot filled with, I feel, she calls out, where, twists of air, I meant to be.